Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by BorgWarner, feel good about driving.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 340 for July 29th of 2016. Choosing cars that could become classics. Watch Autoline After Hours live at Autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. Well, welcome everybody to Autoline After Hours. My co-host Gary Vasilash is out on vacation right now, but I got two of my colleagues joining me today. Todd Lassa with Automobile Magazine. Great having you here, Todd.
John, great to be here as always.
And Chris Pockert, Roadshow by CNET is what he's doing these days. And Chris, great having you here as well.
Good to be back. Thank you.
And of course, one of the reasons I wanted these two guys here is we've got a special guest today, Ray Arendowski. I hope I said that right, Ray.
Close enough.
Close
really
enough.
Good.
Who's also brought in his 1971 Cadillac Eldorado. And we're kind of doing that this, bringing the car into the studio right now because the Concours d'Elegance at St. John's here in the Detroit area is this weekend. And This car is going to be there, right, Ray?
Yes, it is, for the first time.
For the first time? What do you mean? You've been trying to get it into the
show? I've been trying to get it in. It was one of those things that my father always wanted it in. I've been trying, and finally this year, it's going to make its mark.
How do you go about doing that? I mean, I know you got to be invited, right? You can't just drive up and say, hey, put my car in the show.
Nope. You have to be qualified for a class that they may have, and they don't always have that kind of a class. But this is an American post-war. Late, so it fit right into the category.
What did they like about this car? Why did they say, yeah, we need that Eldo in this show?
I don't know, but when you find out, you tell me.
It's the king of the hill. I started reading Motor Trend, which was my employer before automobile, of course, back in 1970 or so, 1970s, early 1970s. It started a regular comparison called King of the Hill, and I think the first one I read was maybe the previous year, the 70 Eldorado, which was redone. The car, this is all new for 1971, all new body, all new design and so on, but the carryover 500 cubic inch V8. And Motor Trend would compare that with the Lincoln Mark III and then later Mark IV every few years or so. And I think they kind of traded back and forth between which one they decided was King of the Hill, kind of depending on which was newest. So I'm pretty sure the 71 Eldorado was King of the Hill.
It's a wild car. And, you know, you mentioned 500 inch cubic inch V8, but it also says 8.2 liters on a little badge on the front fender there. I wonder, is that the first time a metric designation was used on a U.S. car?
I hate to sound like Jim Hall, but no.
Jim Hall, the man who knows everything.
Yes.
Encyclopedia.
You remember the 1966 Ford Galaxy 500 XL, the sporty one?
I know the car you're talking about.
They did list, they had a 7-liter badge on that. It was 427 cubic inches, so they could round to 7 liters, which is basically what that is. And that had a 7-liter badge, and I couldn't tell you for certain that that was the first American car, but it had been done before.
So you mentioned this was your father's car. Can you tell us a little bit about the backstory and why it's important to you?
Well, my father had bought and sold many Cadillacs throughout my whole childhood, even in the grown adulthood, and he'd always find them. I'd always clean them, and he would join in and do the same, and then he would sell them. And this was the very first car that he ever kept for more than a couple of years. I did repaint it. It's an original 12,000-mile car. It's still the original top interior in chrome, but it was pale yellow. We went through some problems, but I ended up tearing the whole car apart and repainting it in black. And I don't know if it's because I did it or maybe he just really liked it because it was triple black and he ended up keeping it. So it was one of the very first cars that he kept for a number of years. And then him passing a couple of years ago, getting to the Concourse was one of his bucket list pieces. So I knew I had to get it in.
So when you say triple black, what do you mean?
Black top, black leather interior, and black exterior.
And black top, of course, because this is
a vinyl top car. You can only get it in vinyl top.
Yeah. What's special, I mean, other than your dad having bought the car and you repaint it, what is it about this car that really sets it off for you?
I think because it's such a cut-line vehicle. It looks like something that was just cut out of the clay and right into production without modifying it or changing things or going to somebody else's idea. I think it's the cleanest and sexiest Cadillac that's been built.
And it's big, too. This is 19 feet long.
Yep.
Which is about 2 feet longer than a current-day Escalade. Just to give an idea.
Right.
And it's a two-door. This is really a coupe. Yeah. And I just love the fact that we used to make two-door cars that were 19 feet long.
Yeah. But you don't feel like it. You could sit in this and not feel like it's an overwhelming-sized car. I mean, you can get into a Duesenberg and be like, oh, my gosh, this is, when does it end? But this, I don't feel like that. I feel like it's up close and personal.
What I love about this era car is the width inside. And, you know, the flat seats just emphasize the width and the expanse of the dashboard. But what's interesting to me, I took a quick poke around your car, is it's got an almost cockpit-style layout with the radio canted toward the driver and all of that instead of just a flat expanse, so it makes it a little bit more intimate.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nice piece of design.
What I like about the proportions on it is, number one, its length. The hood is gigantic. But the other thing that really catches my eye is the juxtaposition of the rear wheel to the sail panel from the roof. And that's a very General Motors look, where when they design a coupe, they move the rear wheel back just behind where the roof line drops, because it gives the car a muscular, almost athletic look. So even though this is, you know, the classic American barge mobile, it's got an athletic look to it as well.
Right.
This was the second generation, by the way, of the original front-wheel drive Eldorado. The first one was 67, 68, 69, and then, 68, 69, and 70, 67 through 70. And then this one would have been the second generation. And I don't remember, I think the 71 was also the first convertible front-drive Eldorado.
Yes.
And that became, for a while, the last convertible Cadillac, production Cadillac. 76 was the last model there. And to your point, I mean, they had to start adding plastic, 5-mile-per-hour bumpers.
Right.
Of course, we had the great smog choking of the engines. So that 500 cubic inches did not put out a great deal of net horsepower.
But an enormous amount of gas.
Yeah. Right. Do you measure fuel mileage?
No, but I tell you, if I get on the gas, I know it by the time I get home. So it's pretty extreme. But it doesn't do too bad if you're just at regulated speeds. Mm-hmm. It's not too bad at all.
Sure.
And, you know, that's a great point about the bumpers, because these are nicely tucked in to the body. It was, what, just a year or two later where they had the big guardrails of bumpers sticking out on the end of it?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. They were huge in the front.
And interesting, the layout, maybe you can describe this better than me, John, but it's a front-wheel drive car, and yet it's a longitudinal engine. And I think the transmission is somehow juxtaposed sideways or off to the side and back, which is unusual, obviously. Front drive cars are almost always transverse engines. Mm. So you have that rear wheel drive dash to axle proportion in that car.
That's interesting. I thought that was just a design decision, but I was wondering about that because it is huge.
Yes.
No,
it's a longitudinal engine, as was the Olds Tornado of that era.
Yeah, no, it does not look like a front-wheel drive car at all. Yeah. But part of it goes back to that 19 feet of length.
Yeah.
And I don't know, what's the hood? 6 feet?
It's over 6.5 feet.
6.5 feet long. So
it's wider than it is length.
Is that right?
It's almost seven. Well, I think it actually is longer, but it's almost equal.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Enormous.
So, The point being is, you know, to your point, it's a longitudinal engine, and they have this convoluted way of getting the automatic transmission packaged in there.
Right.
But they've got so much room, they can just shove it out there, and so you still get that dash-to-axle ratio. Today, we'd never do that. I mean, just look at the overhang in the front alone.
Yeah.
What's that? It's got to be 2 feet just about. And
but it looks proportional. It looks very nice because the whole package is so long. But you're right. You'd never do it now.
In those days, you could do stuff. You could go, oh, you know, the proportions aren't right. Stretch it out another 6 inches there. Today, you can't do that. I mean, from a cost, from a mass, from a crash, all that stuff, you know. So this is still of the era when you could pretty much get away with what you wanted to do design-wise.
That's why I think from my personal favorite era is the 30s. I really think the streamlining was phenomenal in the 30s, mid-30s. And to me, it lost it for a very long time. And to me, this is one of the very first that has that streamline effect for a car of the 70s. Nobody else had it, and nobody else could pull it off this clean.
You're right. Well, actually, I think if you looked at a 71 Buick Riviera, it would have, it doesn't look like this car whatsoever, but it's got, especially at the back end, more of a boat tail.
Yeah, that was the sporty of those cars.
You
mentioned that car because they all had the basic underpinnings, the Cadillac Eldorado, the Buick Riviera, and the Oldsmobile Tornado, and yet the Buick Riviera was rear-wheel drive. The Tornado and the Eldorado were front-wheel drive. They shared some underpinnings, I guess. Yeah.
Well, look, you know, this is back still when Fisher Body was going strong, and those guys were magicians when it came to mixing and matching different kinds of panels and coming up with entirely new different kinds of cars.
Yeah.
Even though in many cases. Not in the case of the Eldorado here, but in some of the lower-priced cars, you know, Buicks and Pontiacs and Chevrolets might actually share some body parts, but they were twisted around and moved in different ways.
Yeah.
So they saved on tooling costs, but still came up with totally different-looking cars.
Yeah.
So what other cars are going to be with yours on display at St. John's?
I've only been told about two, so I'm not too sure. I know there's going to be a 67 Riviera in a 64, I want to say, which I think they're both pretty different designs.
Yes. Yeah.
But they're owned by the same person. Hmm. But they should stand alone pretty well. But those are actually the three I only know about.
Yeah.
So he didn't involve me in the overall pick.
But you must be thrilled getting this car there too. I mean, we were talking before the show, and you say you never miss the Concourse.
I would never miss the Concourse. There's something for everybody, in you know, anything from fashion to art, to the automobile, to the motorcycles, to the sometimes bikes. It all depends on what's going on. Just like the one you've seen, the amphibian.
There was this amphibious Russian Soviet era. Vehicle, I think it was an Antonov 100 or something like that, that was this almost James Bond-looking kind of futuristic thing that was, I guess, supposed to go pick up downed pilots if they were shot down over the tundra or ice areas. So it doesn't even have wheels. It's got this big prop on the back. I mean, it's the ultimate, you know, aircraft for
that's
ground.
A very specific usage case. That's pretty fascinating. That's one of the great things about this particular Concours is that it embraces all different types of vehicles, and a lot of it's more accessible. You know, you go out to Pebble or something like that, and it's, you know, guys with $8 million Ferraris, and they're all rubbed with a diaper, and they don't go anywhere. Yeah. And while they're beautiful to look at and they have amazing competition histories, it's harder to relate to. And, you know, a car like this, a lot of us remember seeing them growing up, and we have, you know, heartstrings get tugged because we knew the neighbor down the street had one, or our fathers had them.
Right.
It's just great to see.
Yeah, nothing on the 18th green at Pebble, that crosses the 18th green at Pebble, is driven on a regular basis. They're all trailer queens. That may be the only drive that particular car gets that year. And at St. John's, it's... like you, people who actually take them out and drive them. You brought it over here. How often do you drive it? Tell us about your...
Still not enough as far as I'm concerned, you know, because we want to make our own memories. And I try to get my kids out there, and the 64 Fleetwood we take out and Still, again, not as much as I would like to, but we need to drive them because we need to show the next generation down that this is where the memories are made from. It's not just a car. It's where we're all together and talking about our parents or talking about where we want to go or what you want to do. So there's a lot to it, more than just a vehicle.
I got to believe this car gets lots of looks wherever you go.
It tends to stop traffic every now and again.
So you have a 64 Fleetwood Cadillac?
Yes.
And then anything else besides these two?
As far as me, myself, we have the 71 Eldorado, and then we have the 64 Fleetwood, and then my wife has a 60 Imperial.
Oh, wow.
So
okay.
Soon enough, I will have that one under control.
You must have a very, very big garage.
Not big enough.
So how many miles on your 71 Eldorado?
I think it turned 12.7 on the way here.
12,700 miles
yes.
for a 1971. That's
yep.
incredible.
I think we bought it. It had 7,800 miles on it. Hmm. So not a lot of gain for the amount of time we've owned it since since 98, I think, is when my father bought it.
But, I mean, this thing's almost showroom quality.
You know, well, he did have a carpeted garage. I don't have a carpeted garage, but he did.
Paint aside, what else have you had to do with it? Or is it's all original interior and the
yes.
top and all of
yep.
that, the motor?
Basic maintenance. I had some brake updating last year because just froze up and things like that. But other than that, it's completely underneath its own original power. Haven't even touched the carburetor. Hmm. Just plugs wires and an air cleaner. We're on.
Everything on the inside works?
Yep. The only thing that just failed on me recently was the air conditioning. It had its original Freon up until just recent.
No kidding.
Wow. Yeah, which is truly amazing.
Truly amazing.
I thought you were going to say the clock.
Yeah,
that's the one
what
thing
I was
that never that never lasts, of course, because, you know, battery.
I didn't check that on the way here.
Yeah.
It's, I haven't checked, but that you
right
might have me
day,
on.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So if people get to go to St. John's, you're going to be where? Do you know where it'll be located?
I don't know what area of the show I will be in. It's post-war late, but they did not give me a field diagram yet. I'll get that.
Well, post-war late.
Yes.
That's probably good enough guidance to be able to find it.
It's an exciting show. There truly is something for everybody, along with a huge art exhibit that all the automotive artists have their own area as well. And I will never miss that area either. So,
good deal. Well, we ought to wrap this segment up here. But Ray, thanks so much for coming along.
Thank you guys for having me.
Beautiful car, great backstory to it, and of course, anybody who's listening to this now in the Detroit area can actually set their eyes on it this weekend.
That'd be great. Always good for a story.
Good deal. Well, look, we're going to take a quick break right now and give a shout out to our friends at Lear.
Lear Kinexis offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Well, we're back right now. Ray's left, but we still have his car in the studio. And like I said, I can't get over a 19-foot-long two-door. I just love the proportions on this car.
You have a remote camera? We should take it for a ride.
Yeah. Shh, don't tell Ray.
Plenty of room in that thing.
Hey, I did a thing earlier this week on Autoline Daily where I looked at four cars that I think could be future classics. And what I'm saying is cars that are out there right now, you can easily buy them. They have not appreciated in value. They haven't been discovered yet, as it were. But I'm trying to figure out, okay, here we got a 71 Eldorado that's sitting on or going to be sitting on the lawn of a major concours. 30 years from now, 40 years from now, what's going to be out there? So I came up with four cars, and I hope we got pictures of those, starting with the Subaru SVX. Do we have that, Carmen? Yeah, we do. And I'm intrigued by this car. You know, it's a Giorgetto Giugiaro design. So, you know, one of the all-time master designers
yes.
did this vehicle. It was all-wheel drive. It had this funky window arrangement where only part of the glass would drop, you know, about enough to pay a parking attendant, you know, and not much more than that.
Yeah, it bows out. It's got a lot of tumble home in that upper glass.
Yeah.
Great thing about that car is that it's the kind of halo car that only Subaru could do, and yet it's so far out of Subaru's regular wheelhouse. You know, they're not, they just do very straightforward crossover SUVs or sedans and wagons and so on, with the exception of the BRZ now, of course. And this car just really stands out. It couldn't be anything but a Subaru, and yet it doesn't make sense as a Subaru. Mm. And I think that may be why, you know, I don't remember what the price was back then, but I'm sure it was by far the most expensive
Subaru.
It was. Subaru.
They were trying to move upscale, go sporty upscale, and yeah, I don't remember the price.
I want to say it started like in the high 20s.
Wow.
It was really quite expensive. It was only sold with the V6, only sold with an automatic.
Right.
Most of them were leather. And I think it was a bridge too far, you know, but now it's really interesting to see.
Was that, remind me, what years was it built?
'88, '89, something
like that.
Yeah, right.
'88, '89.
Yeah. It could be '90, '91. Yeah. I think you're right. Maybe high 20s, back when, remember, this was also at the same time that Honda put the first Japanese car on the market that had a price more than $50,000 or $60,000, which was the Acura NSX.
Right.
Which
so,
the values of those are going nuts now.
Yeah.
And those used to be bargains.
Right. And so that's an obvious one, right? The NSX.
Yeah,
I'm trying to identify cars that I think are affordable, are easily obtainable. And so let's go to the next one. I think the Lincoln Blackwood. You know, do we have a picture of that? I'm sure we do.
There it is.
And, I've probably told this story too often. You know my story about the one Blackwood I saw out in the wild. This is after having driven one as a press vehicle. And I was walking over to the, I was working downtown, walking to the Renaissance Center for a GM press conference or something. And I saw one at the city courthouse, the city hall rather. And I wondered, well, was it the lawyer, lobbyist, council person or whatever? And I saw a hot dog vendor put his hot dog cart in the back. I will always associate the Lincoln Blackwood with that.
With the hot dog vendor?
And with Bruce McCall. It looks like a Bruce McCall drawn vehicle with a small, relatively small greenhouse, an expanse in front of you, an expanse behind you.
Yeah.
Well, the rear end of it, if we can bring that picture back up, was a composite. And you can see those, what look like thin chrome strips on it were inlaid into that. And it had like some sort of faux African wood, if I remember right.
Like Zebrano or something, right?
Something like that. And all I remember is the supplier that made it, which was Magna, had horrific quality problems with it. It was so hard to make. They probably scrapped as many as they built. And so this truck was a complete sales flop. They only built it one model year. I think it was the 2002 model year, and then it was gone.
Well, it didn't make for a very good truck, honestly, because the bed was covered in stainless steel, and they all had the hard tonneau on it, and they had the funky rear, you know, tailgate.
Right.
And you just wouldn't want to put anything in there. And it was expensive.
Other than a hot dog cart.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that your other two cars are foreign, right? Before we get to them, not giving them away. An American car on the list?
I do have an American car on the list.
Beside this.
Right.
It's interesting that for me, it's hard to think of anything from from the mid-80s up until the early 2000s that I might consider a collectible that's also American. But, it's interesting that one that you come up with is a pickup truck, which of course now is the biggest thing on the road in every sense of the world.
And was Lincoln ahead of its time? I mean, you know, now we've got King Ranch Ford F-150s that are $50,000, $60,000.
Well, and they've tried it a few times, right? They had the Mark LT after that.
Yeah.
And that was more conventional.
Yeah.
And that's why I'd say they were not ahead of their time.
Yeah.
Because you had the Mark LT, and then you also had the pickup version of the Cadillac Escalade, and those didn't do well either. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that Ford and Chevrolet and GMC, which has a little bit more of a premium image, if nothing else, and Ram, previously Dodge, Nissan, and Toyota, of course, they are all selling premium trucks with the mainstream badge on it, the Ford badge, the Chevy badge. They're just going way up market with $50,000 or $60,000 pickups without having to give it any other name beside the Ford and the Ram and the Chevy.
Do you think that's because people want to appear humble on some level when they pull onto the job site, and you know they don't necessarily want to be, that's my $60,000 King Ranch kind of thing? Or
no, I think they do want you to know that's my $60,000 King Ranch.
Yeah, they do. It's the King Ranch badge combined with the Ford badge. I think it's trying to appear authentic, maybe not trying to appear humble, but trying to appear authentic. And it really has a similar vibe as Jeep, which, right, after all, you know, for many, many years were just workhorse vehicles. And now, you know, that's the hottest, one of the hottest things on the road.
Well, as you guys know, Mercedes is now going to experiment with pickup. My question is, do they keep that tucked away with all their other commercial vehicles, their vans and the like? Or is there an opportunity here for Mercedes to get into the pickup segment as for urban cowboys, not as a work truck?
Suburban cowboys. You don't want to take any of these in the city. They're way too big.
But I don't even think it'll be as big as something like an F-150, my guess is.
To begin with.
Right. And I don't think they've committed to selling it in the U.S. yet. So that'll be interesting to see how they skew, right? I mean, over in Europe, obviously, they have a much bigger commercial arm where something like that would be far more readily accepted, you know, rubber floors and vinyl seats and all of that, even in nicer trims as well. But they have a whole range of commercial vehicles, which they're starting to get into here in the U.S.
Well, remember, they have the deal with Nissan, so we expect that'll be on the Nissan.
But as you guys know, you can make as much profit on a pickup as you can on a luxury car.
Way more.
Yep. So, and remember, throughout the 1990s, the Europeans and the Japanese all laughed at the Americans and their SUVs. Now, guess what? They all got them, too.
Yeah.
So that's my question. Are they going to go, hey, guys, we're letting GM and Ford and Ram get, we're leaving too much money on the table.
Yeah, if you look at how Nissan and Toyota have struggled in the full-size pickup truck market, Toyota might say it's not struggling because if you sell 80 or 100,000 a year, that's not a bad number. But compared with, you know, the American brands, forget it, it's not even close. And, it's still going to be a small foothold. But to your point, I think what drives this is the fact that the profit is so good that you pay off the tooling right away. I mean, it's just pure profit very early in the life cycle. So it's kind of like, why wouldn't you do it? It's the same reason why you've got so many variations. So you've got these four-door coupe variations of Mercedes and BMW SUVs now. It doesn't cost them that much to do that, to switch it around. If they sell a few thousand of them, everyone's pure profit.
Yeah, and look, remember when Porsche went with the Cayenne? It was horrors, a sports car company making an SUV. Now we don't bat an eye about it. So now we're thinking.
I still bat an eye about it.
Okay.
But, you know, now it's weird when they don't, almost.
Yeah, you know? And so, you know, now we're saying horrors, a Mercedes pickup truck? Maybe in a few years it's not going to be so unusual.
So then the question is, can the Bentley pickup truck be far behind?
There'll be some ambitious customizer that just chops the back off the Bentayga and extends it out a little bit.
Hey, look, we got more potential classic cars to go through, more stuff to talk about with pickups, but we got to take a quick commercial break here. So, Carmen, let's give a shout-out to our good friends at Bridgestone. Okay, we're back. So another potential future classic, Chrysler Crossfire.
Ah, that's the other American, which is really not an American.
It's not an American car. That's why there is actually another American car, but this is actually a German car.
Yeah, it's an interesting design, I think heavily influenced by the success of the Audi TT. And it's got that sort of armadillo tail on the back. And I don't think it sold all that well.
No,
it's an SLK underneath. There were some high-performance models that came later, the SRT6. But it was automatic only. It was older underpinnings and all of that. So it didn't sell in huge numbers. And I remember you could actually get one on Overstock.com. I don't know if you remember that little Dodge that they were sitting around and they tried to do this novel thing and they actually sold them through Overstock.com because they were 25-30% off list. But I think it's a unique design that some people really still gravitate toward. I think that's got a better shot at being a future classic than the Blackwood, with all due respect. I think that's...
That's okay.
The Blackwood, to me, is one of those... because it's a curiosity. It's like saying the Murano Cross Cabriolet is going to be... You know, it's not a particularly good vehicle, but because of the uniqueness factor, the sort of...
I hate to say this, but I'd have to say that about both of them, because to me, the Chrysler Crossfire appealed to people who wanted to buy a Mercedes, not pay a Mercedes price.
Yeah.
And I think that's mostly who they sold it to. And as Chris mentions, older SLK underpinnings, without the magic folding hardtop, and without a manual gearbox option. And, you know, not a bad design in its day, but... I think probably didn't age well. I don't know. I'm having a hard time seeing
it. Yeah, no. Hey, I'm throwing this out there just to create a discussion.
They're plenty affordable now. You could probably pick one up for $6,000-$7,000.
Yeah, exactly. Sure. In fact, higher mileage. I think one listed as low as $2,000, but that was probably beaten.
Yeah.
Okay, and the last one I have on my list is Cadillac ELR. And
one of the best looking General Motors designs in a really long time. Just gorgeous proportions, beautiful interior, but you know, its body was writing checks that its drivetrain couldn't cash. It's basically a Volt, and it's a first gen Volt, and you know, hideously expensive, and I just.
That's one of the major problems. This car is kind of a great example of GM trying to find its way, because before the bankruptcy, there was a lot of talk about, well, shouldn't the Chevy Volt have been made a Cadillac first, because then you could charge a higher price and not lose so much money on it, given that this technology is so new and advanced that, you know, it would take a while before the Chevy Volt could start breaking even, and it wouldn't take quite so long for the Cadillac. So, you know... Maybe it should have been a Cadillac first. Well, no. Rick Wagoner wanted it to be a Chevy. I think probably in the end that turned out to be the right decision. The newer management have developed that car very well. To Chris's point, again, the problem now with cadences, unlike in the era of this 1971 Cadillac Eldorado, GM cannot afford to update everything in the lineup at the same time. That's related. So the Cadillac has older technology than the Chevy has for $20,000 or $30,000 less. It makes it a curiosity. They sold very few of them. Will it be a collector model? You know, the problem is they couldn't sell them at the sticker price when they were new. How much lower does it have to go before it starts coming back up again? I don't know.
You could buy, I remember doing a story, you could buy an ATS coupe and a Volt and be cheaper than the sticker on the ELR.
Well, you know, the ELR started at $75,000, and then it went nowhere, so they dropped the price $10,000.
Mm-hmm. And
boy, for anybody who bought one already, they must have felt screwed.
Yeah.
And now you can get them for, I would say, about $30,000 to $50,000.
And I'd say you're still paying way too much, other than if you just want a beautiful design in your garage.
A very handsome car, and by the way, makes me think that maybe the more... And this may be too obvious, but the more collectible car, because we see a lot of them here in Detroit, but I don't think a relatively large number of them in Detroit, but I don't think
I've seen one this year.
Well, no, I was going to say the car I'm talking about, though, is the Cadillac CTS Coupe.
Mm-hmm. I think that'll
Wagon,
be a collectible car.
I think those two will be collectibles.
Yeah.
And, of course, if you drill down into a CTS V Cooper Wagon with a manual gearbox, then you're talking...
Rarity.
Wonderful car, and half of them... You know, we're press pool cars.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, and that's what I tried to go for in picking these. And look, I just wanted to spark a discussion, right?
Discussion.
But my criteria have been it's got to be relatively rare. You just don't see these things very much. They had to be interesting in a visual way and or in a technological way. And they have to be something that's sort of readily available right now but haven't caught on yet. That's what I'm trying to look at is, And I love what you guys just said, that CTSV wagon, especially a manual one,
sure.
Very rare. I know some of our other viewers wrote in. One of them said the Cadillac XLR, you know, which was essentially a rebodied Corvette.
Yeah.
And people came in with all kinds of things from all over the map. But that's what I'm looking at. What's going to be on the lawn at a Concours in 30 or 40 years?
I haven't. I don't know what the values are now, but have you looked at the values of the Cadillac Elante? Have they...
That's a good question.
I think
they're probably... that's a very clean design, actually, when you go back and you look at it, right?
That was Pininfarina that did
it. That had the world's longest assembly line. That was the nightmarish process where they literally flew bodies back and forth.
Yeah.
It was
in the middle of the U.S.
In special planes. Utterly insane. But still, you know, a good-looking car, and the later cars with the North Star, not a bad-performing vehicle.
So typical GM, right? By the last year of production, it was perfect, so they killed it.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think the hot segment seems to be right now is early SUVs are picking up a lot of traction. Things
like what?
Or like early 4Runners, 3-door 4Runners, 3-door Pathfinders. Even, you know, some of the earlier stuff, the International Harvesters, Scouts and stuff like that. And workaday trucks like Chevy CKs are going pretty well. Late 70s, early 80s, sort of thing. And those you can still find for reasonable prices, and, you know, they're solid utilitarian designs.
So you raise an interesting question. Does that mean that as mainstream buyers, as the vast majority of people migrate from Toyota Camrys and, Ford Fusions to car-based crossover CUVs, does that mean that there will be some sort of, nostalgia and therefore collector interest in good old-fashioned truck-based SUVs?
Good question.
Yeah, and I also wonder about early crossovers when it gets down to it. I mean, I don't think things like, and this is further down the field, I don't see like a Pontiac Aztec being anything other than an ironic statement, but like an Infiniti FX45. Great sound, really interesting look. You know, first generation car, you get the orange leather and all that stuff. And the V8, I really like those cars. And I don't know, maybe we'll start to see some nostalgia for that sort of thing.
I'm guessing the Pontiac Aztec's going to be at that Concours de Lemons on Saturday.
Yeah.
Hey, we were speaking so much about pickup trucks and changing topics slightly here. What do you guys make of this report that pickups are starting to catch on in China? And the numbers are still very small, let me say that. But I want to say last month, pickup sales were up like over 30% in a market that was up not nearly that much.
Well, 10 or 12 years ago in China, there was no interest whatsoever in sports cars. And so that's kind of come a long way in that, you know, you could sell Rolls Royces, you know, people wanted those, the rich people in China, obviously. And but Ferrari, no, not really. And that has changed. Sport utility vehicles were, it was all about the three-box sedan until, I don't know, late in the last decade, I believe. And my understanding of the Chinese market, at least. And now that has changed quite a bit, of course. Crossover SUVs are huge in China.
Booming.
And so, you know, are they just discovering new models slowly, and then when they find them, well, this is the latest thing?
Well, I think for a lot of the markets, because of the spatial and pollution issues that they've got in some of the megacities, they banned the sales of pickups that are of that size. They had the little commercial runabouts, but that was it. But then people started to bring them in on gray market. And, there were $100,000, $150,000 pickups. I remember Ford saying that Raptor sales that went over there were surprisingly strong there and in the Middle East. And now Ford has announced that they're going to bring the next generation Raptor there officially. And that's going to be a six-figure vehicle.
Yeah, I got to believe it's over 100 grand.
So you've got the rich people at the upper end, the tastemakers, that are saying that this is cool. There's merit here. And then so that can't help but trickle down a little bit.
Yeah, when I was at the Beijing show this year, there was a lot of, sort of like Hummer knockoffs. Not copies, but I'm saying big, bold, muscular, gigantic SUV things.
Right.
And, and then just down the aisle away, there was the Ford Raptor. So, yeah, I think this is another change in the Chinese market.
Well, the Chinese market has mimicked the U.S. market, at least to the extent that the Chinese early on did not embrace the hatchback and preferred a three-box sedan, even if they could only afford a small compact or subcompact. So, and of course, that's now changing a little bit in the U.S. finally, but, you know, they've kind of copied us or followed us more so than the Japanese market or even the European market,
right,
to a certain extent. And so maybe it's not that much of a surprise if there's any kind of interest in American culture, if, you know, if they're watching Western movies on TV, I don't know. Maybe that's part of it. Maybe that's part of the image.
Yeah. Hey, we got more topics to get to here, but time for another quick commercial break. And Carmen, let's give a shout out to our friends at BorgWarner. And we're back. So speaking of, marketing SUVs and all that, what do you guys make of the story that Volkswagen is going to allow its U.S. marketing arm to name its next SUV? Because heretofore, every single one of its models have always been, the names of them have always been chosen in Germany.
And kind of chosen by Ferdinand Piak, who's no longer there. I mean, he had this thing about, you know, the Tuareg people and a lot of a Middle Eastern vibe to the names. And I think a lot of this probably has to do with the fact that they are just completely stumbling in the U.S. market and have since the late 1970s. And that, you know, this is a very American kind of vehicle. I guess they're going to sell it in China. I'm not sure if they've announced that or not. But
I'm sure they will. Everybody better be thinking about selling SUVs, right, and crossovers.
Yeah. But it's not a European model.
It's too big.
Hmm. Well, you know, I think it'll be there, but just not in big numbers. I mean, Mercedes and BMW and Audi all sell their full-size SUVs there. They just don't sell a lot of them.
Sure. But that's at a different price point, right? That's in the luxury segment where people can absorb that and the fuel economy and all that.
And don't forget, the European Passat is different from the American Passat. It's not as large still. They still have two Passats or more.
Does a name make a difference? Can a name sell more cars?
It always helps when people can pronounce the car name. So Tiguan, which was a melding of tiger and iguana, there was some contest-winning horrible thing that came out.
Tiger and iguana.
That's what it was, yeah. And it's a little trivia question. It sounds like I made it up, but it's actually true.
No, it's true.
And then, the Touareg, people can't spell. People can't look it up in search engines very easily. It's ungainly.
It reeks to me a little bit of desperation of this whole thing with Dieselgate, and that it's interesting if they come up with a really good catchy name. Think about how luxury car brands, both American and foreign, explain the reason why we've got a Cadillac CT6 and not a Cadillac Fleetwood Brougham or DeVille or something like that, is because Cadillac wants people to think of the car as a Cadillac, not as the model. Well, if you have a whatever they end up calling the Volkswagen, the monkey bar, the Volkswagen monkey bar, people like monkey bar and say, I'm going out to buy a monkey bar, not a Volkswagen, and monkey bar won't be associated with TDIs.
Yeah.
Could be. I think it's an overdue change. It'll be simple, and it fits the form of all these other vehicles. You know, it'll probably be named after, you know, some rugged town somewhere in North America or the world, and it'll be easier to pronounce, and it'll fit more in with the landscape of people that buy these types of vehicles. Is it a big deal? Probably not, but I think it's an important win for Volkswagen.
Oh, you're right. You look at Hyundai or Kia. Hyundai, you know, Santa Fe and all these Western
Tucson
towns.
So. Yeah.
Yeah, I think a car name doesn't matter entirely, but when you get the right name for the right car, bang, does it work. Mm-hmm. So Mustang, Corvette, sure. Charger, I mean, that all works. Or here we've got Eldorado. Yeah, I mean, those kinds of names, I think, really work with the car, but I don't know.
Let's start
looking
at Western towns, I guess.
Yeah.
hot springs or something. I don't know.
Right. Another topic I wanted to ask you guys about, Chrysler or FCA confirming they're no longer going to build passenger cars in the United States. They'll make them in Mexico, maybe. They'll make them in Canada for the time being, and elsewhere in the FCA empire, but not here. What do you think about that?
All the eggs in one basket.
Yeah.
Well, yes.
I.e., meaning they're only going to build trucks and SUVs here and right. All that. And what if that market gets hit?
Yeah, and it's an eventual concern. But frankly, they haven't proven to be very adept at building and selling cars at a profit, the ones that are that well-regarded. I mean, the 300 and Charger, they've been around for a long time, and they're based on old Mercedes underpinnings. They're nice vehicles in their own right. But go smaller, and they've struggled with everything. I mean, the Dart is, frankly, a not very good vehicle. And I don't think the Fiats are selling particularly well. They don't make any money, so.
Well, and that's the thing. They have no margin, and this is really part of a bigger trend, I think. If you look at the German manufacturers, most of them will continue to build their German or any European manufacturer, including the Italians, will continue to build their premium or higher profit cars and their trucks. SUVs in Germany or in Italy, in the case of Alfa Romeo. But then the Fiat, the Volkswagens, some of the Opels are made in Czech Republic or Poland or other parts of the new parts of the EU where the costs are much lower. And same thing here. You want to be building, I think, your passenger cars, your compact, subcompact, maybe midsize sedans in Mexico. And you build your SUVs where, even if they're a mainstream SUV, a Chevy or a Ford or a Dodge, in the United States, you still have a bigger margin on that SUV versus the compact car. And then you also build your luxury brands here. You build your Cadillacs, your Lincolns, and so on here.
Save on shipping.
But it's, you know, as long as there's a NAFTA, which, yeah. Who knows, come November, next January, as long as there's a NAFTA, it makes a lot of sense to have your thin profit margin cars get a little bit more of a profit margin by building them in Mexico. I can't fault them for that, frankly.
No, you can't.
And
Mexico is our Eastern Europe, so to speak.
Exactly.
Or Eastern Europe is their Mexico.
Very much so. And luxury cars, bigger profit margins make them here.
And what do you guys think about this fake sales reporting, you know, that the FCA lied about their sales?
Well, it shows the intense pressure that everyone is under to continue that sales streak. When it was something like, 75 months or something?
Yeah.
And then they had to roll back, a couple of years worth. But they said through their own forensic accounting that they actually may have underreported numbers. It was just over some months and under some other months. But overall, I think they sold 19,000 more vehicles or something like that.
To me, it was such a minor discrepancy. Yeah.
You wouldn't seem to need to do it if you consider how low Chrysler's sales were in 2009 and 2010. I mean, they were really scraping the bottom, so anything would be up. And it also reminds me a little bit, wasn't there some BMW reporting a couple of years ago where they were pulling some sales from the next model, the next calendar year in January into December to try to beat
Mercedes?
Yeah, election. No. That was last December.
It was last December. It seemed forever ago.
Well, everybody plays with numbers.
Yeah.
I shouldn't say everybody, but we know that certain companies have played with the numbers. But what BMW got caught doing was telling dealers to buy a whole bunch of demo cars.
Right.
And if you looked at last December, sales of the i3 and the i8, boom, they did really well for what they are.
Right.
And then they paid the price for it.
Because, this is not to excuse Fiat Chrysler.
No. No, not because, they've been bragging, 47 consecutive months of increasing sales. Well, now we know, that the sales streak ended some time ago.
Yeah.
And now they're getting investigated because could that have had a material impact on the price of their stock?
Mm-hmm.
That people think, sure. Oh, they got all this momentum and they keep getting better and better, so I'm going to invest in the company. Whereas if the truth had been known, they were still doing fantastic, but they couldn't claim 47 consecutive months. I think it was 41 consecutive months or whatever.
I hate to say this, but will this prove Elon Musk right that you should just throw out a global number every 3 or 4 months or so, or what?
Well, I wonder if there's not some some numbers tweaking at Tesla too. I mean, we keep seeing stories on in forums where they're finding, you know, parking garages full of brand new Model S's and even Model X's that are just sitting around and they're collecting dust, and you know, it's interesting.
Yeah.
Hey, we've got some questions coming in here. So our work wants to know, do the plastic fascias on the Crossfire and others make them unappealing as collector items?
Everything's got a plastic fascia. I mean, so many cars do.
I think, as Ray was telling us, this is the last all-steel car Cadillac made.
Yeah.
You know, it has no plastic on it, or certainly not on any of the body parts. And this is a 71, so everything's had plastic since the early 70s.
The question is going to be, when the judges at Pebble Beach 40 years from now look at these cars, will they take points off for not having the right software update to their info nav system?
That's a good question. Like, you're a month out of date here. You're a month ahead. That's not correct. So we have to backdate you for that.
Yeah.
Our work makes another good point. He says, a problem with the ELR, you know, which I selected as a potential classic, he says, it's the battery. A gas car can sit in the garage with an empty tank, but can be used with fresh gas. A battery car has to be used to keep it useful, and down the road is totally dependent on the usability of the battery.
Great he mentions that, because that's actually going to be a problem, is that when you get a new battery for your ELR 10 or 20 years from now, you're not going to get the original battery, or it won't be exactly the same.
In fact, it'll be a fraction of the size and, you know, a fraction of the weight.
Well, they have to build the original battery pack basically for 10 years as replacements, and because they're batteries, they couldn't build up a bunch of them when the car came out and then just store them. I just had a tour of the Brownstown Township factory, and this came up, and so yes, they will build a new battery for your ELR, say 5 years from now or 10 years from now, and will it be exactly the same as, you know, any kind of upgrade that they've made to it since then, which I guess won't be much since this is the last of that battery pack, you know, it's not going to be exactly the same.
Right? I wonder if it'll be catastrophically expensive because people won't be building batteries of that type or size at that point, or if because the technology's moved on so much that the cost has gone down. And
well, GM says it has to do that for 10 years. That's part of, you know, the FMVSS.
But we're talking about 20, 30 years from now.
20, 30 years from now, right?
No, that's a great question. Yeah. You know, like with all the electronics, who's going to be making the chipsets for your iDrive in your BMW in 20 years? Nobody is.
No, chances are, you know, there'll be some kid like my son with a Raspberry Pi, a little computer with an emulator that you just stick under the dashboard and you connect, you know, one connection and all basically just emulates everything.
On the other hand, you've got 3D printing, so maybe that'll help.
Yeah.
Have your part 3D printed.
Okay, Sam wrote in to give us some information on the Subaru SVX. He said it was sold from 1992 through 1996.
Wow, that late.
Had a 3.3-liter flat boxer engine.
Yeah.
He says, one of the most enjoyable cars of the day, I thought. Hmm. I remember driving it. It was cool.
Mm-hmm.
It was cool, but, you know, I there was one in the press fleet. I got to drive it, and I don't think I've ever seen another one on the road ever since.
Oh, yeah. I see them every once in a while, but the thing is it predated in large measure the idea of all-wheel drive luxury, right? I mean, Audi was still doing it, you know, pretty consistently, but not everybody else had really made it a cornerstone of their brand, which is
especially in a two-door coupe.
Yeah.
So Michael Ma from San Francisco wrote in to say, the internet is still buzzing about GM building a mid-engine car for 2019 to 2020. Will this new car be a Zora or a Cadillac? And or do you guys even believe they're going to do a mid-engine sports car?
I think there's, yeah, I think the writing is on the wall. I've just heard too much rumblings from various sources that's going to happen. And I think it'll be a Corvette. I think it might be called the Corvette Zora, but I'm not sure they're going to do two Corvettes. I think maybe GM has decided, for better or worse, that's the future direction of the car, that they've done everything they can with the Corvette in its traditional configuration, that the next thing is how do we really nail down the handling and
see, I think there could be two Corvettes for two reasons. Number
one,
there
should.
We had Taj Jukter in here when the current gen, the C7, came out, mm-hmm. and we asked him about mid-engine. He says, I hear all about this. There's the rumors are all over the web. He says, I'm here to tell you unequivocally there is no such program. He says, none that I know, and he says, I think I ought to know if there is such a program. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was vehement about it, not going to do
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
But then you look at the Ford GT, and they're not going to make a whole lot of them. Right. It's essentially a hand-built car. It's mid-engine. I mean, come on. Isn't that the way to do it if you're going to compete against them?
I agree. I've written about how they should almost make that a sub-brand and sell them in both Chevrolet and Cadillac dealerships, and that they should maintain the traditional Corvette as a front-engine, rear-wheel drive car that would be affordable, would be a cheaper alternative to a Porsche 911, as it's always been. And then also do a higher-end mid-engine car, which actually could just be a Cadillac if they so chose. But I'm hearing otherwise, and I may have some misinformation or disinformation.
Yeah, I think you're right, though. I think it's going to stay Corvette. I think there is going to be a mid-engine car. I think and I hope that they keep the two-tier thing going. Because I think one of the great things about the Corvette for a long time is its everyday usability, you know, real trunk and all of that, which it's a weird thing to talk about. But you talk to Corvette owners, longtime Corvette owners, and they brag about how much stuff they can fit in or how great their gas mileage is and their visibility and all of that. And you just won't get that in a mid-engine car. But I think you're right. I mean, there's so much action now in the $150,000, $200,000 price point and up. They can't build enough of a lot of these types of cars. So there's a market for that. So I think, you know, if the performance is there, they could probably sell both. And frankly, we've already seen a lot of those grainy, very long-distance spy shots.
Yeah.
And granted, they're all camouflaged, but when you look at the back end, doesn't say Cadillac. The lights say Corvette.
Mm-hmm. Well, that might be their mule, too,
could,
right?
Could absolutely.
It's hard to judge those cars, yeah. or, you know, extrapolate from
sure,
them.
Sure.
Well, and the thing is, if you're talking about a two-tiered Corvette, so to speak, yes, I think there almost by necessity will be some sort of overlap. But whether that's more than a year or not, think about the entire sports car market. Sure, you know, Porsche's doing well, but Porsche's doing well selling more Cayennes and Panameras than their sports cars. You know, the Miata and now the Spiata come along and they sell well for the first year, but then settle down to a pretty small number at a much lower price point. You know, there's some sports cars, the high ends, the Ferraris and the Lamborghinis will be around, but things are changing a lot. The future of the auto market will be a lot different. This a lot more car sharing is what we're looking to next. Autonomy that will eventually kill off the stick shift. You know, maybe there won't be so much room for sports cars that are somewhere between mainstream Miatas and Fiatas and the high-end cars. And then you've got to talk about CAFE and all those other things. So maybe eventually there will be room for just one, and it'll be that higher-end, more expensive car.
And I'm intrigued by what you're saying. Sell it in Cadillac and Chevy dealerships.
I think that's what they should have done. That's what they should be planning to do. I don't know that they'll end up doing that. But if they separated Corvette as a brand to a certain extent, think about this is not a really good comparison, but think about Scion, where you have a little bit of a separate dealership. And you already have, obviously, some Chevrolet dealers are more have a reputation where they sell lots of Corvettes, and they're selling to a much different, a lot of the cars are going to a different clientele than your average Malibus and Cruises or Silverados. And then you think about the fact that the very few Corvettes that they sell in Europe are sold through the Cadillac dealers mm-hmm. in Europe. So mm-hmm. it makes sense.
Good
to
point.
A
Good point. Extent. We got a question from A.M. Guerrero in Manila in the Philippines. But we should have kept Ray here because he's asking, what's it like driving an Eldorado with this massive amount of torque with an 8.2-liter V8 in front of the front wheels? And, you know, this is still the early days of front-wheel drive.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, compared to where we're sitting right now, that's right. The early days. So I'm sorry, A.M. Guerrero. We should have had Ray for that question. And then one last comment here. Wes Ride sent this in via Twitter. He says, our friends at Fastlane Daily have been let go. I love their content as well as yours. It was a sad day in car news. Yeah, and I hadn't heard that.
I saw an item on Twitter, I think, about Time. They're owned by Time.
That recently, they were purchased by Time along with The Drive. And unfortunately, you know, they've been around for, I think, you know, something like 8-9 years.
Yeah, and they've been around
really,
a while.
Really long time, really early into the daily news updates on YouTube for the autosphere. Always sad to see colleagues, you know, go without, and I think they had a loyal audience. Mm-hmm. So it's a shame. They said, you know, it's not being canceled permanently, that it's on indefinite hiatus. It doesn't sound so great, but maybe somebody will pick them up and resuscitate it. I don't honestly know. But you have to wonder if Time bought, you know, Drive, the video platform, with the intention of holding on to that and developing that and then just kind of pushing that Fastlane Daily off to the side quickly. Don't know.
Nope, don't know either, but hope those guys land someplace because they did do a good job. Hey, we're going to have to wrap it up, but I want to thank you both. Chris Pockert.
Great to be here. Thanks.
CNET. Todd Lassa, Automobile. Great having the both of you guys here.
Thanks, John.
And special thanks to Ray and his 71 Eldorado. And, of course, got to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by BorgWarner, feel good about driving.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv. So, good.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. It was fun.
No, good topics. And
now I get to look at this.
Had a lot of good things to talk about.
Drink it in. That's
that's a lot of car, yeah.
You know what I like is this sort of fake grill right behind the door there on the leading edge of the rear fender.
Yeah.
You know, just it's just there for pure styling. Yeah.
I'd referenced something from the 30s to Ray's point, I think. There was maybe not. Maybe
I'm not
maybe
sure.
Like an Auburn or...
I wonder, we've always been seeing it on like these future car things that if spats will ever come back because of aero.
Yeah.
You know, I thought they would, and in fact, if you remember, Ford did a series of aerodynamic studies that they called Probe. It was the Probe 1, 2, 3, sure. And I think it was up to the 4. They even had spats on the front wheels that would. I'm trying to remember how it worked, if it was like a flexible membrane or something that pulled out, you know, because when you turn the front wheels, you know, you're going to impinge on those things. And they had some mechanism for allowing you to turn, but kept that for aero reasons.
Which sounds very complicated.
It does, right?
Yeah, way too complicated. Yeah.
Or just, you have a really, really narrow track. Just the
middle. I think it was the same car. Remember, you know, in aerodynamics, the air flows over the body, and when you get to the back end, you know, you get all this turbulence, and you want to keep the airflow attached to the sides as much as possible. So, and I think it was the Probe 4. They literally had vents on the side, but at the rear of the car that would suck air in and then vent it out the very back of the car. So sucking it in helped maintain attached flow, and venting it out the rear sort of tricked the airflow into thinking you had sort of like a Kalmbach design to it. Wow. And they picked up quite a few counts of aero that way. But again, very complicated. Yeah. You got to run all these fans all the time.
Well, the first-gen Probe in 89, the first year it came out, that was the most aerodynamic production car that year. The GL had a 0.29 CD.
Wow.
I guess the answer to your question might come from a study of how much better aero do you get with spats, at least in the back, versus perfectly flat wheels.
Well, they ran out the Insight like that. The first gen Insight had little spats, and was that the last car with production car in North America with spats on it?
Which one?
The Insight, the first gen Insight.
Oh,
the little two-seater.
At least of any volume.
No, I think you're right. But on this car, it was not done for aero.
No.
It was done purely for styling, and it just makes the car look that much longer because you're not really interrupting,
Look at the overhang in the back.
It's gigantic.
You only see that on like an 18-passenger van today, you know?
Right.
But it's great.
We had growing up, we didn't have Cadillacs. We had Oldsmobiles, but my dad bought at least three in a row big two-door hardtops. My sister and I, so we didn't have any kids, any siblings, so
welcome back.
So Ray, I'll ask you now.
I didn't pick out my favorite part of the entire car.
No kidding. Yeah.
This,
it's gorgeous.
Because once you went into 73, they slapped the molding back on here and completely interrupted the whole
thing. Yeah.
I love just like the huge expanses of uninterrupted sheet metal like that. You know, it's just...
So what is it like driving this car,
It doesn't feel like it looks. It doesn't feel long at all.
But do you get torque steer and all that or not?
If you get into the gas, you'll get torque steer.
Okay, you do get some.
Yeah, but not anything like what you do out of a more modern front-wheel drive car. Mm-hmm. It's not as bad today as it was, maybe 10 years ago or more.
You get a lot of squat so that if you do stomp on it from a stoplight, the front ends,
get light.
Front tires get light. And
I'll rip those tires right off the car.
Yeah.
They will unstoppably not stop.
Yeah.
So we're still live, but you can keep talking, but we're going to pull the car out while we're live, just so you all know.
Oh, okay.
Ray didn't have his mic on, so maybe he should answer that about the... drive.
Just put that mic right on.
We're kind of in a post-show mode.
We're in the post-show mode, but people still watch.
The gentleman who asked the question about what it's like to drive.
What's it like to drive? What's the torque steer and all that like?
The torque steer is not bad at all when it's when you're driving like anybody normal. If you're heavier in the gas, it may pull a little bit. Being that I still have the original style tires on it, the bias ply will drag. If you're in a crease, it's still going to pull you one way or the other, but I wouldn't change that for the world because that is the way the car was.
Yeah.
But all in all, when you're driving, you do not feel as your car is 20 feet long. it actually feels very personal, and that's why it was a personal luxury car. You didn't feel that coupe de ville feel where you felt like you're on cloud nine and could drive it for 16 days and never have a sore. but to me, it's very, very personal.
And you've got the light steering, and how are the brakes?
They stop pretty well.
Yeah. I mean, you have discs up front at least,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. Yep.
So,
like my '67 Eldorado that I previously sold, that was I think the first year that they offered the front wheel disc
GM,
brakes.
Yeah.
And that car also drove phenomenal. Sad to get rid of it when I did.
You know, I got to regret that the Boulevard ride that is so,
it'll come
put
back.
Down by
it'll,
the
it'll come back.
Media.
It'll come back because when autonomy takes over, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Steering feel doesn't matter. The firmness of the brake pedal, none of it matters. It's just how comfortable is my couch.
Well, and modern suspensions now, you can have that balance of ride and handling, and of course the downside to the PillowSoft ride was the first turn. You really had to slow down quite a bit, otherwise you're just gonna nosedive into it.
Right, but I would argue that for 90% of the car buying public, the Boulevard ride is really
Absolutely.
What they want.
Oh, there are way too many sport packages on vanilla cars like the midsize. Midsize front drive sedans,
Camry SE,
they just
whatever,
go way overboard on the hand, trying to make it handle, and it's kind of like, what difference does it make?
Everything else is switch related now, so I don't see why you can't.
There's that
turn a
too.
Switch to put you right on cloud nine.
Yeah, great point.
But I want to say the only thing that even comes close that I've experienced recently is on the Lincoln MKZ. You can go into on the screen, and there's multiple suspension settings, and you can go for the loosest one possible. And that's getting close to it. But the Boulevard ride was that floating feel. Yeah. It wasn't just soft.
Floating.
It just sort of floated. Yeah. And these days, with so many roads around the country, here in Michigan especially, being in such poor condition, it's even more reason to have that Boulevard ride.
I think a lot of it, too, though, was...
Here, hold that up, too, so they can hear you.
We were in a fight to compare ourselves with the European ride, with BMW and Audi. With a younger crowd buying a more expensive car, they wanted to feel the road, mm-hmm. whereas the older people don't want to feel the road, and they still own the pocketbook.
Well, and there's more of a need for that over in Europe when you have higher speeds on the Autobahn and you've got twisty roads. Yeah,
yep.
Right. You need that.
Well, and you're exactly right, and just to get back to that 8.2-liter badge on the car, this is kind of the nascent period of Cadillac already seeing that, hey, look, people are buying more Mercedes in the States. There's this brand called BMW. They mostly make the little compact two-door. But, you know, we're seeing these foreign guys encroach into our area. And then, you know, a few years later, you had the Seville, which had the 5.7-liter V8 and was supposed to be very much a European sports sedan mm-hmm. type of thing, and the Lincoln Versailles. And, yeah, I mean, it was just a few years away. And then, you know, we remember those years, John, where, you know, between that and OPEC and the big bumpers and the federal regulations and the regs, what it did with bumpers and so on was really take these bodies, to your point, when they were updated, you know, get rid of some of those nice styling touches, and they became kind of blocky and...
Right, fat and heavy.
Yep. Yeah.
That's why I like some of the resto mods where they're just doing really subtle tweaks and they're just tucking the bumpers back in, or they're removing the overriders and all that. It happened to the British sports cars too. Like, you know, look at the TR8, you know, mm-hmm. they're just
sure.
these massive rubber bumpers. It just looked awful.
Sure.
It's like I was in before when I was earlier days, I liked the hot rods and the very clean line new designs, and there was I imagine the cars I love, which was these cars, because they were embedded in me, what I would do to change them. And I remember looking at cars and dragging in the bumpers or eliminating them and just putting little details in there would make the body look phenomenal. This one, I came up to blank. I really had nothing to do. I wish I could get rid of the license plate pocket in the front. That's about the only thing that I would love to get rid of. But other than that, I think this body is one of the cleanest that they have ever had for a very long span of time.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool.
Thank you guys for having me.
Yeah, no, thanks for coming over and especially bringing the car in here. It's always good to have a car in.
I love the hood, not just the size of it, but, you don't notice it from the side, but how much they're peaked, you know, when you look at it from a plan view overhead or, you know, when you see it dead on. Because here it just looks almost monolithic, but you look at it, there's so much depth in there. That's cut in. It's great.
Right.
So, Ray, that front license plate pocket is built into the bumper. It's not detachable?
No. No, because I think in the 70s that you had to have a front and rear.
Yeah, I think every state. Well,
depended on the state.
Well, yeah. But most of them did. Yeah. There were a couple of exceptions.
Now, if you could eliminate that, that would altogether look...
It would look a million times better. It really would.
Yeah.
You thin out the bumpers in the center there a little bit more, and I think it would altogether thin it out even.
I bet you Chip Foose could do that for you if you had some spare change.
I'd take a run at it first before I give it up to somebody else.
Right.
But
hold on to the original as is. Find a spare to monkey with.
Well, John and Chris know that my wife and I just got ourselves a 1960 Austin Healey Bug Eye Sprite Mark I, and we got it from bugeyeguy.com in Connecticut, a guy who specializes in the cars. And he said, so do you want the front bumper on or off? We said off. And that was an option, or it might have been required, at least in some states in 1960. And it really transforms the front end of the car.
Cleans it up so much.
Yeah, and at this point, you know, if you're in an accident, it doesn't matter.
Believe
anyway,
me.
Right?
Believe me.
It's all, no offense, but it's all over.
Oh, believe me. I understand. I mean, it might barely match up with the bumper on our Miata, but not much else.
And besides, those bumpers were just, you know, thin chrome ribbons.
Yeah.
You know, it might have protected you a little bit in parking. Not you, but the person backing up to your car going, oh, I hit it. Oh, there's a.
There it is.
Yeah. Ours has the original steel wheels, but it's the same color. We have iris blue, which is fairly unusual for that car. It looks like this one. Is that right-hand drive? I can't tell. Anyway.
Left-hand drive.
Left-hand drive. From here, it looks like right-hand drive. So, yep.
Very cool. Yeah. No, I can't wait to see your car.
So, well, yeah, I'll be happy to bring it in sometime.
It'll fit.
It will fit.
We'll bring five of them in here.
I think it's about the length of the hood, Ray.
It's Skittles. Yeah. He's bringing a whole rainbow of colors. Yeah. So,
my boss has a, Brian Joseph has a smart car, and it's funny when he's parked next to me because it's literally within
the front
windshield to the front of that fender.
Yeah.
You're having way more fun than he is.
Yeah, yes, I am.
For sure. Yeah.
Well, cool. We need to let you out so the crew can break down here.
Thanks for bringing
it again.
Yeah, great.
Great talking to you guys.
This is great, man.
Never watched the show before, but I will from now on.
Cool.
Thank you, guys.
These turn signal indicators.
Oh, yeah.
So you don't go driving down the road with your blinker on. This is going to remind you.
Plus, it runs well with the line of defense. Yeah. Whereas the 73 got really bulky and fat. I had a 73. It only had 12,000 miles, too. It was triple white.
It's great that the plate matches the car.
Oh, my God.
It is great, yes. That's really nice.
It's like a custom plate.
Yeah. It is. It's an original plate, but my dad had every one of his cars that placed master car. So I don't think you're allowed to do that anymore, but I think I'm underneath that.
You know, I'll bet this chrome piece, it's got to weigh 20 pounds, right?
It's heavy. It's heavy. This whole rear bumper assembly is incredibly heavy. Yeah,
so you had this pretty much apart to redo it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, dude, I took you unless you take this car, strip that top, there's no way you're going to find anywhere of original paint.
Or you don't need a golf club diagram in this one. You know, the modern cars like small trunks. They're like, you can fit a golf bag in here, but you have to wedge it in this way.
That's right. You can take a golf club in your manager caddy.
You can throw in a few caddies. And
this is a good guy's car. You could put three or four bodies in
there.
All right, guys. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think I'm on Thursday.